Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you another Art Monthly talk show, which goes out on Resonance FM and then is also on Art Monthly's website at the end of the month, on our events page, and also on all good podcast apps forever, it seems, or as long as the world keeps turning and there's electricity for people to access things with. Today, I am happily joined by Bob Dickinson, as well as Tom Denman. Hi, both. Thank you very much for coming on.
Hi.
Bob's in Manchester and Tom's in London. Although Tom just said he was in Manchester yesterday at the Whitworth, so that's quite funny. Bob obviously didn't go, so otherwise they might have bumped into each other. I don't know if you guys ever met, have you, before?
No.
But both write for Art Monthly regularly, so that's great. And we're going to talk today about a feature which Bob Dickinson has written, called in Art Monthly, Rest is Resistance. That's Rest is Resistance. And we're also going to talk about a review that Tom Denman wrote about a show at MIMA Middlesbrough called Towards New Worlds, which goes on until 9th of February 2025. And there are some shows in Bob's feature which also go on for quite a while. And when we come to them, hopefully we'll remember to mention them there, that they're still on if they are. There is no absolute link between the two pieces, but the sleep is very much a part of Bob's feature, and it is mentioned in Tom's review. So at some point we'll make that connection. But we're going to start with Bob's feature. Bob, interestingly, there's a kind of connection which I would never have made, and there's a few things in your feature which are opening my mind in a good way. And the connection at the beginning you mentioned is between climate crisis and sleep crisis. I didn't know there was a sleep crisis. I knew there was a climate crisis. But connecting the two is very interesting. Can you just maybe begin by explaining that connection or how it's possible to make one?
Well, I discovered by sort of researching, reading it up, that, you know, there is a sleep crisis, which means like increasing numbers of people are being deprived of sleep. They don't get enough sleep. And, you know, the obvious cause in European countries and maybe, you know, Western countries is work, overwork, too much work, and being encouraged to work when you should be getting some rest. And, but one of the other reasons why people aren't sleeping very well is climate change. In other parts of the world where sea levels are rising and the weather is changing dramatically and it's causing stress and mental illness, and that's contributing to sleep deprivation as well. So our current woes, you know, with regard to getting rest and sleep are are being caused by two aspects of capitalism. That's what I'm arguing, that capitalism creates this tendency for people to overwork and work too much and not get enough rest, and it creates this stress due to climate change. Climate change is the other thing that capitalism is causing, and we've got this big crisis regarding sleep as a result.
Right. And there's been exhibitions which are have taken this theme of sleep particularly, but also exhibitions about work, haven't there?
Yeah.
And obviously there's been exhibitions about climate crisis, which you don't particularly cover those in this feature. I think it's mostly work and sleep. I think I'm right in saying that.
I don't really get on to sort of looking at an artist who's dealing directly with climate change in her part of the world until the end of the article, but I was kind of I think the title of the piece comes from an exhibition in the United States by a group called Black Power Naps, which happened last year. And it was called, and it's called La Biblioteca is Open, and it introduced some very interesting information to me, which is that Black people in the United States are twice as likely to get insufficient sleep compared with white people. And there is this connection going back in history between sleep deprivation and slavery. Those artists, Naville Acosta and Fanny Sosa, built a kind of a rocking environment, which was like a reassuring, cradle-like environment where you could sit down, lie down, and read books and go to sleep, get some rest. And they were referring in a lot of what they were doing to a writer called Tricia Hersey, who began this project called the Nap Ministry in the southern states of the US, which invents or encourages different techniques to counteract what she calls grind culture, which is basically capitalism and its tendency to make you overwork, but also to stop you from daydreaming and stop you from fantasizing.
Yeah, that was interesting. You mentioned daydreaming at school, like when we were at school. Yeah. If you were like drifting out the wind, looking out the window and drifting off, then you were told not to do that, which in a sense I can understand in the classroom you might, but it is a very valuable thing, and perhaps lots of artists should do more daydreaming and touch their dreams more in their work. But that is a definite thing that we lose, isn't it, when we're working, because we're held to concentrate on something that we have to do, which we might not really want to do.
Yeah.
Why do Black people, presumably Black people are less likely to get sleep compared to white people because of the type of work they're doing and the hours they work? Do you know?
I think it's hours that they work and type of work, but also the mental stress of being right. African-American.
Just the plight of being that in life.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
But I mean, I was very interested in what, you know, Tricia Hersey's Nap Ministry, the way she associates the possibilities of sleep and rest and dreaming, which enable Black people, Black Americans to dream, but also to time travel, to re-examine their lives by dreaming. And that links, I think, to Afrofuturism and writers like science fiction writers like Octavia Butler and musicians like Sun Ra, Pharoah Sanders, and so on.
Where they're imagining the future for themselves, yeah. in a powerful way.
Yeah, where they're imagining, dreaming different futures based on their own history.
Different possibilities.
Yeah, different possibilities, yeah.
Tom, is that, you know, your review fundamentally is talking about I'm very wary of how to say this, really, but you're dealing with disability in your review in that show at Mimmer, and in that sense, that's a kind of very delicate balance that thinking about when I say that, I mean the exhibition at Mimmer, and also there was this event you went to, I think, at Somerset House.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Did you go to that? But there was a.
I didn't actually attend the event at Somerset.
There was a conference, wasn't there? Basically, trying to create the right future for disabled people in the right way, you know, especially within the art world. Again, it's a sort of that there are people who are not necessarily being treated correctly in some way. In this case, you know, not being joined in with the world in a full sense because they're disabled, and trying to make it so that they are. And then we've got these Black Americans who are not sleeping properly because they got their own plights. I mean, that's a bit of a tenuous link in one way, but then there are problems which art in these cases seems to be trying to solve. Is that?
Yes. Yes. I think what in the review, one of the main objectives, which I saw parallels with the event at Somerset House called Hyperfunctional Ultra Healthy, which was last year. Having read up on that event, the main parallel, it seemed to me, is that some artists are trying to look at disability not as something that is all to do with just the disabled body, but something that extends beyond that. So to look at it as something that is very important to consider, not as something that is sort of cordoned off from, let's say, the able-bodied world. The disability and disability access must be understood as something integral to art criticism, art curation, art making, going to museums. The very idea that anyone, whether technically speaking or officially able-bodied or disabled, ultimately is using their body most of the time in trying to access these artworks as an audience member or as an artist entering into an institution or a gallery to show their work. The show seemed to blur the distinction somewhat between what is disabled and what is not. And one of the ways it seemed to do that, in my view, was by not really emphasizing the disability of each artist involved in the show. So sometimes you're just dealing, the one artist might be, for example, might for instance, be blind, but you won't know that. You would experience their work through I'm thinking at the moment of the artist Aaron McPeak, whose work involves sound and touch primarily, also vision, because you're looking at these metal bells or these metal sculptures, which you're invited to touch or to strike in order to create sound. But it just as a way in which might displace the primacy of sight in your engagement with art.
Right. So it's not about, say, touch or sound, therefore visual. Yeah. So going back to Bob's, this cradle thing that you were describing for rocking, that's presumably a thing. I mean, it's a positive attempt to try to draw people into a better feeling and rest of some sort, whether it be in the gallery, but also to making them very conscious of the importance, presumably, of sleep and rest. Bob, that in that way, that sort of connects in this, you know, drawing attention to an issue. Both these exhibitions are both doing that, aren't they? They're both.
Yeah. Something else that I thought when I was reading Tom's review was, you know, in a way, these experiments, artistic experiments, may kind of signpost ways in which museums and galleries could be redesigned, not in a permanent way, but in a kind of constantly changing way. So you could enter a space that changes all the time to encourage different visitors, different people, because everybody's got some kind of problems, I suppose, mental problems, physical problems. It's we've dealt with sort of access problems to museums for years, but perhaps I'm just fantasizing a bit, but perhaps we should think about museums and art galleries as spaces that can constantly change, or which are consciously aware of the need to change. That's the nature of the space and the way the space works.
Yeah, I mean, the subjects of your, I mean, obviously identifying needs seems to be, and you do, I think you suggest really that in a way art is a very good place to do this. You know, some things in the world are not catered for, you know, they're not thought, then there is no place other than the art world, perhaps, where these things might be dealt with.
I think it's coming from, in the case of the sleep and rest issue, it's coming from also partly from the academic world, from the research side of that, because I started off by writing about a project that happened earlier this year up in Northumbria, that was organised by an academic called Dilessa de Cristofaro from the University of Northumbria, who devised this event called Understanding and Reimagining Sleep, with the help of an artist called Chiara Delaba, who held an exhibition called An Oniric Journey to the Nearby Cosmos. Oniric means dream related. And stemming from this exhibition, she released a set of tarot-influenced cards that are there to help young parents with very young children who are having sleep-related problems. And you can download these cards free from the internet. You know, on one side, there's an image, and the other side, there's some advice about how you can deal with a particular problem. And the days have gone when I had young children, so I haven't been able to try it out. But I'm quite interested in this interaction between artists and sleep-related academics.
But it is a kind of, it's almost like the artist is creating therapy. It's interesting that there is this crossing over. I mean, I'm sometimes wary about, you know, the research or academicization of art, but equally that, you know, there's nothing, if there's some great ideas which we all draw all the time, aren't there, from the written word particularly, and yeah. It's always interests me how they translate into, you know, the actual experience when you do go to an exhibition or you do see the actual art, wherever it may be. But because you mentioned someone called Jonathan Crary at the beginning, Late Capitalism and the Ends, that's plural, of Sleep.
That's this book.
Thank you. 24/7.
Yes.
I didn't mention the 24/7. That means that relates to like 24/7, never stopping.
Never stopping, yeah. And that book came out in, I think, 2013, and it's had a huge kind of impact on the way a lot of people think about sleep and capitalism. And it's had a big influence on artists as well. In fact, there was an exhibition in 2019 that I've written about very briefly called Insomnia 24/7 at Somerset House, which features this very interesting thing, a piece by Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, called Somnoproxy, which involves using a dream machine, which is a thing that was devised in the early 1960s by Brian Giesin, Ian Somerville, and William Burroughs. And I actually built one once. I've actually made one. It's not here now. I've lost it, but...
What's it like?
Well, basically, it's a cylinder which has a light inside it, and you put it, and it revolves round and round, and the cylinder has holes punched in it or cut into it, and you stare at it.
It spins.
It spins round and round. What I did is I built. I got the pattern. You can get the pattern off the internet. I got it from a magazine or something.
Yeah.
And I kind of scaled it up using a photocopier, I think. And it's cut into sort of very strange sort of shapes, crescents and so on. And you have to copy the specific pattern. Then I built this. So I turned it into a cylinder. I painted it black. And I put it on an old record player. And I sat in a darkened room with a light suspended inside it, and I switched on the turntable to make it go round.
I don't know what you're going to say next. What?
Well, it does induce, it induces a kind of semi-dreamlike state. It's completely legal, I think. And, I think when they were devising it, Giesin and Burroughs and so on thought it was a bit like the kind of feeling you get when you're driving along in a car. It's a very sunny day and you go through some woodland and the light is dappled and it goes and it flickers on your face and it relaxes you.
But not like a strobe light. It's less harsh.
Yeah, there is a real effect from it. It's very subtle.
Just remind me, was there one of these in the exhibition?
They used one in the exhibition. It involved a film and a gallery. Yeah, obviously.
Sorry. More examples of you've got lots in your piece, but you also mentioned another artist, Dana McLeod.
Yes. Canadian artist who has been doing a piece called A Sociability of Sleep Project, using cameras, but spy cameras to watch her. She's a queer artist. She films herself and her partner asleep, and she's had sleep problems for years. So it's a kind of surveillance project, I suppose, where she records herself having nightmares, waking up, shouting, and she even did this project in an arts centre in Montreal. I can't imagine what it's like to actually go to sleep deliberately in front of an audience, but that's what she did. And that's a sort of ongoing thing that she's been working on for several years.
Tilda Swinton did that in The Serpentine in 1965, yes. And she sort of slept inside a glass case in part of Cornelia Parker's show. I'd forgotten all about it, but I'm just still kind of like to tease out this thing about the importance of sleep, like, you know, in a sense that why some of the people who've written about it, for instance, this Dr. Diletta De Cristofaro, doing this research, I mean, presumably based on the fact that she thought that sleep, as you say, has been undermined or is being, you know, people are, but what is, I mean, I know it's obvious, but sleep is a very valuable thing. I'm just interested to talk a little bit more about why, in a sense, like, you know, because it seems to be about power. It's like being able to choose when to sleep is all equally important, not just.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think people, De Cristofaro, Dr. Diletta De Cristofaro relates. Again, sleep to capitalism. She says the capitalist system is geared to continuous extraction. So it's like you're extracting your energy, your consciousness, your abilities in the same way that it extracts valuables from the earth, from growing on the earth and from inside the earth. So it's she thinks about it in sort of political terms, but in a sense, I think current work patterns encourage some people to really go beyond the natural limits of their tendencies to sleep. And I was very interested. I've been very interested in the way that executives and some types of worker use drugs like Provigil to keep awake so that they can work beyond the normal capabilities and limitations that people can work. It's absolutely crazy to me, but that's what some people think is advantageous to them.
Yeah, some there are drugs used for narcolepsy, I think. Yeah.
Yes,
which brings me across to the review of Tom's, because in Tom's review, you talk about Leah Clement's film Collapse. Don't you, Tom? 2019 film, which is about narcolepsy and chronic condition. I mean, that's a form of disability, isn't it? Not being able to sleep.
Right. So there's narcolepsy is actually, if you undergo too much, you when you undergo anxiety, you pass out.
That's right. You go to sleep in order to avoid stress.
It basically is just an automatic. Yeah, I think it's like a physical reaction and a neurophysical reaction that you under at times of stress, at times of anxiety, where some people might dissociate. In the narcoleptic, it produces this urge to just pass out, which is unbearable. It's overwhelming. I mean, so you just need to fall asleep. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's beyond your control.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a conscious decision. It just happens, presumably.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sort of beyond one's control. So you are kind of, you become sort of pathologically unproductive in the kind of capitalist sense of what being productive is.
And your stress could have been caused by something to do with pressures from work, or presumably. I mean, it can
be that, or anything. There might be, I don't know, maybe there could be various triggers, I suppose, that can cause this. And actually, Leah Clements, in the film, what she does is in the film is she films someone, I think it's herself, in a sleep clinic, and she has these, and if the film is done through a kind of night camera or some kind of solarized lens, and so you can see through her clothes into these kind of monitoring pads that are on her body, and she just kind of falls asleep on a bed in this room, and the film therefore goes in and out of, kind of blurs in and out of abstraction in a way, because the camera, sometimes she might fall asleep very close to the camera, and the solarization effect makes it quite difficult to see what's going on, which kind of captures a kind of fogginess, I suppose. It kind of captures a kind of mind fogginess you might associate with a very being on the cusp of consciousness, or being in a kind of very sleepy state. But, and in it, over the top of that, you have voice recordings of narcoleptics discussing their experiences of it, and at least one of the contributors talks actually about her condition as a kind of resistance, but not a resistance that is involuntary, but nonetheless a resistance to capitalism, because she cannot do what capitalism wants her to do, which is be a workaholic, essentially, because she will fall asleep. So involuntarily, there is a kind of resistance in the condition, which is kind of explored in this ambiguous way.
Because resistance, rest as resistance is in your piece, Bob, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, because it is quite interesting. I was actually quite amazed by that idea that saying something like that is great. I mean, the idea that taking rest as a resistance. I had a job once as a hospital porter all night, and we used to just go to sleep. But then we all got woken up if there was an emergency. I was on casualty, and we'd have a little room and go to, but the idea of sleeping on work, that's the only time I've ever been in a position to do it. But as resistance, it's quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think I don't think this is altogether a new phenomenon. I think it's not a new phenomenon at all. Obviously, the Black Power Naps exhibition reminds us of the heritage of slavery and the way sleep deprivation was used. But I think it goes back to, you know, this sleep deprivation is as old as capitalism is, you know. And I was one of the other artists I'm writing about or wrote about is Sam Meach, who's part of an exhibition in Graz, which I think may still be on. And it's another of these 24/7 related shows called Work Between Meaning and Imbalance. And he's done this thing called Punch Card Economy, which relates to the 888 rules that were proposed by Robert Owen back in the 19th century, in the early days of the mills and early manufacturing capitalism, who was a philanthropist who also tried to run an ideal kind of factory called New Lanark. And he proposed that there should be limits on how you should, how long you should work and how long you should rest. And so he came up with 8 hours labor, 8 hours recreation, 8 hours rest. So Sam Meach, the artist, has came up with an idea for to make a banner, a knitted banner, using a hacked 1990s knitting machine, which uses data sets reflecting temporary work patterns, which is usually what the kind of work patterns that people have to have in this kind of environment nowadays. And there's a glitch in the pattern for every hour worked beyond the 888 rule. So you've got this knitted banner, which is full of the, which is covered with this kind of strange chaotic pattern caused by the glitches. And there's a really good film about how he goes about making this banner on his website, which I really liked. I really enjoyed looking at. So yeah, I think this isn't a new battle that we're experiencing. It's an extension of something that goes back to the 18th, 19th century.
Yeah, well, presumably when unions got involved eventually in to make, try and get better conditions and time would have been part of those, I presume.
Definitely, yes, yes.
Yeah. Tom, let's just give you some time as well on your review. There's a word that's just leaping out at me, which is maintaining opacity, which is quite interesting. You say... I mean, I'm not going to explain it. I'd like you to sort of talk a little more perhaps about that and or about what this different approach to disability is. You were describing beautifully the blind artist's works, weren't you, earlier
yes.
on?
Yes. Well, I figured that opacity seemed to be a kind of unspoken theme throughout the show. Because of this not pinning down how each artist is disabled, not pinning them down as disabled as such, although they all identify as disabled, by applying what is known as the social model of disability, which kind of shifts attention away from the disabled person to the society that might not be able to actually look after the disabled person. So it kind of inverts the mold in a way, and I think one of the ways in which the alternative model is the medical model, which is very much focused on the body of the disabled person, and just kind of pathologizes them or looks at them as a component of their illnesses, or looks at them as a part of them, just looks at them as an illness, as it were. And so one way in which the exhibition seems to challenge this way of looking at people is by maintaining this opacity. So essentially giving a kind of affording some kind of private space to the artist so the artist can exist as a person. We don't look at the artist and think, look at the artist's work and think, okay, this is the disability. We don't look at it in a medical way, which is a danger, I think, in this kind of thing, is to try and sort of break every work down to the disabilities that kind of feed into the work. So even with some works, for example, one is a film piece by Molly Martin called Misshapen States, and we are told that Molly Martin experiences epilepsy in the wall text, but we're not told why the work necessarily is a representation of epilepsy or anything that clear cut, and we're not really allowed into her experience. She in this film, she is in a river, and she is holding these kind of seemingly very uncomfortable poses in what seems to be the cold water. And in the background, we hear this kind of very intense breathing, And so the word gets under your skin. You begin to feel a certain bodily intensity from this film. But you don't know, you can't say after that, this is epilepsy because of X, Y, and Z. It's just, it creates empathy with the artist, creates empathy with a situation, with the artwork. And without you possessing the artwork in a cerebral or clinical kind of way, if that makes sense.
Yes. And you also mentioned Christopher Samuel's Archive of the Unseen, which even in the title, it seems to be suggesting something to do.
Yeah, actually, yes. This work, in some ways, at first, to me, it seemed to stand out because the work is actually not incorporating opacity as such. It's almost the opposite. This is an archive consisting of several videos in which he talks frankly and directly at the camera, describing his experience of Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, which is a neurological disorder that affects sensory and muscle function and is very debilitating. And he talks about what it was like growing up in as a black working class boy in Britain. And in this one, it was almost self-consciously not opaque, in that it's very direct. But however, I think it still has the same function as a lot of the other works, which are more opaque in the show. Because ultimately, the main aim is to try and prevent the gaze, the viewer's gaze, from entering into them and classifying them. And his frankness, I think, in some ways is kind of oppositional. It kind of puts the viewer in place. He's still very much in charge of the conversation. He's not allowing people in. He's taking control of the narrative. So I felt nonetheless that it still had the similar overall aim of maintaining that that autonomy.
I mean, when thinking about power, I mean, in Bob's
power.
The artist retains the power. That's what it sounds like to me. I was interested in Bob's piece. You talk about work a bit. There was like some examples. You go away from sleep to work, because obviously there is this link between capitalism depriving people of sleep and making them work. And Santiago Sierra, who's not an artist I found very easy, you use that example of that, you know, where people are told to write a phrase over and over and over and again. It's a kind of almost like a punishment. It's where the power is just not there, is it? I mean, the artist has got the power, but it's a very different kind of work, isn't it? Because some of the examples in your feature are positive attempts to deal with, you know, deprivation of sleep, and others are absolutely not.
No, well, I mean, Santiago Sierra is very controversial. Well, that particular piece is controversial because he's part of that same 24/7 work between meaning and imbalance exhibition at Graz. Repetition of the writing of a phrase involves different people from a migrant background being involved in the piece and having to write the phrase repeating the phrase, "I will never take the job of a European." It's meant to be ironic, I think, but I think I'm not sure, I think
that's the problem with irony, isn't it? It often fails, but it no, really, I always find irony, and I've said it before on this program actually, that it's a worrying form of work, really, can be.
Well, yes.
Very hard to get it right, isn't it, really?
Yes, yes.
It's interesting. It's the line of being positive is what I take from Tom, the exhibition Tom's reviewed, is that, you know, it's a towards a positive approach to something. And the same with your, you know, a lot of the sleep works.
Yeah, I mean, I could be completely wrong here, that because I'm interested in the way artists are trying to change the way we think about the world, you know, and the world we live in is capitalist, and we can't really argue about that fact, but we can try and change our lives in some ways, in small ways, and I think our artists and spaces where artists work can help us rethink our relationship with the system that we're stuck with.
It's difficult one, isn't it? Because if you draw attention to things which are difficult or bad, to be simplistic about it, you're still trying. Your aim might be the same, positive in the end, but you're not actually coming up with any direction, alternative direction, and that's obviously. I mean, it's on my mind at the moment, particularly because I've organised a show, and in the end, there's a sort of. It was about entropy. And I was a sort of, well, that was what was in my head. But obviously, it's a downward leaning slope in one sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm my underlying feeling about sleep and art when I was writing this piece was that artists are in a way realizing or proposing that the problems that we've got with sleep are far more urgent than we thought about them maybe 20 years ago, because I look back at some exhibitions that happened around about 2005, up to about 2015, and they're playing around with sleep, you know, like Ilya and Amelia Kabakov's House of Dreams at the Serpentine Gallery in 2005 was like a Russian cosmist idea of how we could try and get in touch with our unconsciousness again. By going into this ideal world where you go up steps and there's a bed on top of a pedestal and you lie on the bed and there's sort of fantastic visions that you can look at through some curtains.
Are they paintings? Well, I wonder what the fantastic visions were. What were they?
I'm not sure.
I wonder what on earth that is. I was quite intrigued.
And
Carsten Holler, you mentioned Carsten Holler, didn't you?
Oh, well, that's completely bonkers. I mean, his idea of this thing he did called Soma in 2010, where you pay £1,000 to stay in a mushroom-shaped hotel in a disused railway station in Berlin, in the company of 12 live reindeer, and along with the 12 live reindeer, there's refrigerators with bottles of reindeer urine, and the reindeer, they when they live in the wild, they like to eat, among other things, fly agaric mushrooms, which are those mushrooms that will probably start appearing in a wooded environment somewhere near you in the next few weeks, because they're an autumnal mushroom. It's the classic red-capped mushroom with little white spots.
Highly poisonous, I think.
Highly poisonous, yeah, in their raw
site. Right.
You have to be very careful with them. Anyway, the reindeer don't care. They just eat them. And you can drink the urine of a reindeer and get the effect from the urine. And that was what Carsten Holler was doing, yeah.
For a slightly sideways look at sleep without being terribly sensitive, really, was it?
I think since then, I think people have become artists. Some artists have become far more urgently concerned about the situation with regard to sleep and rest.
Yeah. Going back to Tom again. Tom, you mentioned some other people. I just think it'd be nice to talk a bit more about it. So Jenny Julia Wallin Paimonens. That's a great name, isn't it?
Yes.
Good Lord. Four words. Sleeves for a Paralyzed Hand, 2015. You mentioned her and R.A. Walden's work.
I found some of the works quite they seem to have quite a therapeutic, positive outlook. They seem to, and that was one of the other things which I noticed in the show, aside from this kind of opacity, which I thought was an important thing to bring up, but some of the artists seem to be using art as a way of a way of kind of healing, or of a way of caring for themselves, and they have this sort of there's almost like a metamorphosis that occurs in Jenny Julia Wallenheimer's Sleeves for a Paralyzed Hand of 2015, because in that it's a kind of a montage. It's dedicated to a friend of hers who is a dancer with a paralyzed hand. And in that, it's just a, it's like a slideshow with some intertitles, with some affirmative statements. For example, one of them is, "The sensitivity of my hand is part of my sexuality." That's sort of an intertitle. Whereas the rest of it is made up of this slideshow of a mannequin, and the hand will just change. There'll be some kind of wires, orange wires, sewn with beautifully tied knots instead of the arm. Or there would be a the arm will be dressed in this very elaborate sleeve. There'll be a champagne bottle. So there was something, you know, these are kind of thing, there was a lot of beauty in the work. And I think the beauty in itself has a kind of generative feel to it. It has a, it's almost beauty is kind of be, here seems to be harnessed as a way of, introducing a kind of very positive and therapeutic, I think that's the word I'm looking for. There's something quite therapeutic about it. And I noticed as well in Colin Hambrook's works, he has these drawings, very intricate landscape drawings, in black and white, a little bit psychedelic. Certainly they have a kind of a psychological feel. They could be kind of, they look a bit trippy, and they're very absorbing. And they but with them, he had these leaflets. In fact, I have one with me here, in which he would just describe what the landscape and the drawing means to him in very clear prose. And the feeling one gets is that the artistic practice is kind of therapeutic. And I think also standing in front of these drawings and looking at the drawings and reading the text as well, reading text also slows down your engagement with the work. So again, it's talking about this slowing down. It just slows down, makes the whole process rather much more meditative. Kind of, there is something therapeutic in that on both sides, I think, for the artist and for the viewer. And another artist I mentioned in this regard is R.A. Walden, who has collected these little samples, and they can be of sort of natural specimens, which look like maybe twigs or bits of liquid from the environment. And they're in these little jars, and they're neatly labeled on a table. And I found that interesting. I found it interesting how the concept behind it. So looking at these works, one already feels this sort of sense of delicacy, this sense of attention, this sense of care. And then when you find out that actually R.A. Walden's own engagement with the natural world is somewhat limited by some kind of disability, we're not told what the disability is, but it's restricted, then suddenly these works, suddenly you realize that there's something rather affecting about the care that has gone into this display. And I think some of them have, I remember, names of friends on them. So maybe these specimens might have been taken from by friends of hers or friends of theirs, sorry, and brought to them. So there's something quite affecting and therapeutic about the work.
Well, very sounds, I mean, quite moving, I think,
Yeah.
really. But also very, by the sound of it, cleverly drawing attention through the work to someone else's situation without banging on, it's not
Yeah.
like in an obvious way, which is clever, I mean,
Yeah,
and
and
sensitive.
I think so. I think sometimes, I mean, I was reading Glissant's Edouard Glissant's essay on opacity. And for him, you know, one of the most important things about opacity is that you do not need to know absolutely everything about someone to connect with them. You don't have to, they don't have to be transparent to you. And I think that's something very important for our engagement with art a lot of the time. If you feel it, if it can encourage a kind of empathic engagement, then you don't have to see through it with an X-ray all the time.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of privacy as well is
Yes.
important too, isn't
And
it?
with that dignity, yeah.
Well, exactly, and not everything that we all have problems with, we want everyone else to know about, but we would still like to empathy.
Yes.
Just how do you get it without having to pour everything out?
Yeah.
Some artists are very, very, blinkered, myself, me, everything's out there. And in a way, you turn away because it's too much all in one go. And in a way, you might get better response. I don't know. I suppose if we went to sleep a bit before we were pummeled, as it were. I don't know. Mm. I like your description of it anyway. You mentioned, sorry, I'm just looking at the review as we're sitting here. Caroline Lazard wrote a 2019 primer, Accessibility in the Arts, A Promise and a Practice. You mentioned it in your review. Is there anything you could say about that to us?
Yes, certainly. This actually links a little bit to what Bob was saying before about institutions and spaces being evolving, but in a constant in constant flux, moving to accommodate or even to accommodate and challenge at the same time, but not in a way that's restrictive. So essentially, the clue is in the title, really, which she describes as a promise and a practice. So she says that, you know, a lot of disability access or accessibility in general must be understood as a promise, not a guarantee. It's a constant work in progress. It constantly needs to adapt. That's why she describes it as a speculative practice, which is the quote that I pull from it.
Which should probably be the approach towards sleep, really, in a way, shouldn't it, Bob?
It's like, not,
sorry, go on, Tom.
Sorry, not 888 necessarily, but something a bit more.
Well, yeah. Yes, I mean that's very prescriptive in particular, isn't it? But it flexible on that, and I mean I think perhaps for things like the way people work at home now is quite intriguing effect on all of this in a way, isn't it? Because you know, if you're disabled and you work at home, it might be your best environment to be in for work. Or equally, you know, if you've got more control, perhaps, over how your working day runs. I think that's a change which has happened. I mean, you know, I can have a nap if I want to occasionally. And when I used to go in the hot monthly office, that was not possible. we don't do it anymore. So I sometimes have a half hour nap when that's nice.
Yeah, maybe more of an integration of life and work.
Yes, which obviously, ideally, you would want, wouldn't you? Because you work shouldn't be, as you say, Bob, you know, slave. It's not slavery. It shouldn't be slavery.
No, but then you get into sort of things like with freelance work and working from home, you and they are related, I think. You get into the precarity of work. The way that it's very short term for lots of people, and that's another cause of stress.
Yeah,
where you're constantly worried about where the next lot of work is going to come from.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of self-employment.
Yeah.
Issue, yeah. which was introduced probably, I don't know, is it in the 90s or something. I think I became self-employed in the mid 80s. Actually, no, mid 80s it was probably, and that it has been the case for years. Really, that you're right. I mean, I was trying to put a positive spin on you know, work at home, but there, as you say, the things we don't have.
Well, it particularly relates to artists. You know, that's the condition for lots of artists.
Absolutely. No. Well, I mean, currently there's a huge, I mean, I'll just bring this in because you mentioned artists, but studio costs and the prices of rent are really exorbitantly in London, particularly now. And I don't know about other cities, but probably the similar in big cities, particularly. It's a real problem for artists, and they are stressed. And I know that there's lots of great speak about, you know, organisations saying they care for the well-being of artists and things, but it's very hard for them to do it. To actually, they can say it, but it's not necessarily the reality. And the stress of earning enough money just to have a studio, for some people, they don't have any time to be in it.
Yeah.
Let alone sleep. They go to sleep in the studio, perhaps, when they get there.
Anyway. Is this what you do? How much time do you have in the studio, Matt?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. No, I do. I'm very lucky, and I have a studio in a wood, and it's I'm on my own. It's in the bottom of someone's garden, and it's by a pond. And I have a large chair, which I had as a child, which can be pulled out like it goes quite horizontal, and I sometimes just lie down in it and have a rest. It's great, and it's very quiet there, and I just hear birds and things. I'm very lucky. So, but quite a lot of time. Yeah. You know, I was there all day yesterday, mucking about in the mud.
I like the idea of the childhood chair. That takes you back to...
Yeah, no, it really is. It's one we used to take apart and play with as a kind of playground. And then my father died and I inherited it. And I've just got it. And I still manipulate it now, but just really for its stretching out and sleeping mode. It sits there beckoning me, which I try to avoid by keeping cold. Which is easy in studios because we can't afford the heating, can we?
Oh, dear. Of course.
No, I've got a wood-burning stove, actually, which I'm not really supposed to use in London. But anyway, listen, guys, it's been great to talk to you both. I think we've introduced your pieces, I hope, to people. They're both in the, I didn't say at the beginning, but they're both in the October 2024 issue, 480. That means we've made 480 issues of Art Monthly, and we're creeping towards our 50th birthday soon, which I think is in a year or two's time. The Art Monthly 1976 beginning never ceases to amaze me. And there's an archive on the website now of all the issues, which has been there a while, and you can subscribe to that and go and have a look. But basically, do read these pieces in the magazine, listeners, if you would. We'd all like that, I'm sure. No point in writing if no one reads it, is there? Anyway, but thank you both for coming on the Art Monthly Talk Show. And I'm sure you'll come on again in the future, and I'll see you when you do. Have I forgotten to say something really important? Anybody tell me I have? I don't think I have.
Thank you very much, Matt. And thanks. Good to meet you, Tom.
Nice to meet you too, Bob. And thank you, Matt.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Hello, this is Matt Hale again. I'm just giving you a little bit of information about how to subscribe to Art Monthly, because we offer both print and digital subscriptions. You can do it quarterly or annually, and for an individual in the UK, it is £11 plus £3 post and packing for a quarterly subscription, or £42 plus £11 post and packing for a year. You get 10 issues over a year. Alternatively, you can do a digital subscription, and that is £8.99 per quarter. So to get a subscription from Art Monthly, just go to our buy page on our website, www.artmonthly.co.uk. On the buy page, you'll see all the options available. Thank you.